Hello and welcome to another edition of the Built on the Border podcast. I am your host, Tom Randolph, and with me, as always, Mr. Tommy Watson and Mr. Broderick Johnson. How are you guys doing today?
Excited to be back from this long break.
Yeah, we've been on a little bit of a hiatus for the last 2 weeks. Travel and then the holiday, and just some things getting in the way of us doing the show, but we're glad to be back, taping it again. Monday, June 1st. We're in June already. It's been a fast start to the baseball season. It's already summertime. Kids are out of school. It's time to do some more outdoor things and enjoy that nice weather. So we'll go ahead and jump right into the week that was with Royals baseball. The Royals had a rough week, going 1-4 in series against the New York Yankees and the Chicago Cubs, getting swept out in New York in 3 games, and then splitting the 2 games that they were able to play out at Wrigley, 1-1, winning the game on Friday, and then losing the finale in the 11th inning on Sunday, with that Saturday game getting rained out. And I first want to address that Saturday game getting rained out, because I'm sure it was a huge bummer. You got to think there was a good amount of Kansas City fans that spent good money to get out to Chicago for this weekend, fly or drive, whatever it was, buy the tickets, make their hotel arrangements, whatever it is. And then if they were just seeing that Saturday game, they missed it. We had some friends that were traveling down there for the Saturday game, and they weren't able to attend. So our heart goes out to those Royals fans. That was kind of on our radar of things to do this summer, was to attend that Saturday game between the Cubs and the Royals. Very glad now that we didn't try and go, but it's kind of a bummer when you plan an entire weekend around a sporting event and then that sporting event gets canceled and then gets rescheduled for the last week of the season when the Royals will be in Chicago again for September 28th. So it's a real bummer. What are you guys' thoughts on the Royals missing out on that opportunity to play in Chicago this past Saturday?
You know, it's really just unfortunate for the fans, because for the players, that's a day off for them. I mean, I'm sure they were kind of looking forward to playing another game at Wrigley, but let's be honest, I'm sure they all appreciated getting a night off.
Right.
But for the fans, that really just sucked, because I mean, I know a lot of people saw that schedule when that game was scheduled and knew they wanted to go up there, and they made, like you said, they made a whole weekend out of it, and they had plans, and then, you know, the highlight of the weekend gets canceled for a lot of them.
And it is a bummer. And, you know, yeah, the Royals do get a day off, but they had one today where they were able to go out and play in a charity golf tournament. But now they lose that day off later in the season, which is when you kind of want to have those days off. You know, you have that day off September 28th towards the end of the year. Now you don't have that anymore. So we don't know what kind of wrench that game will throw into everything later on in the season. Now they'll be in Chicago. They'll be playing the White Sox, and they'll just mosey on over to Wrigley Field to play that game. But still, it does throw things off a little bit in terms of a rhythm and in terms of a pace. And who knows, the Royals might have been carrying more momentum into this week's series against both the Indians and the Rangers. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. Yeah, it's nice the players got a day off, but you know, later down the line, who knows what kind of impact that will have. So now after this weekend and in the past week, the Royals are now they have 29 wins in the season, which is good for second place in the American League Central. The Minnesota Twins are now in first. They've got 30 wins. The Royals now a half game behind. And the Royals about to start a 3-game set at home against the Indians. And the Indians are hot recently. Brody, you said they've recently won a nice set of games. Now their record's 24-26. What do you want to see from the series with the Indians coming up?
Well, our first pitcher is Guthrie on Tuesday. Really trying to see if he can bounce back from that horrendous embarrassment of a pitching outing.
Absolutely. I think this is probably his last chance to really show this ball club that he deserves a spot in the rotation. I mean, he had a really rough start to the year, then had one of the worst historic starting outings ever last Monday. Mm-hmm. And so now you want to see, is that a fluke? Was that bad outing just, you know, a bad day? We all have our bad days, whether it be work or personally. You know, that happens. Anyone who's played a sport knows there's going to be bad days. But when it's a consistent pattern of subpar pitching performances, then you start to have to reevaluate your rotation, especially with the younger guys that the Royals can bring in. In that game where Guthrie pitched poorly, Finnegan came in and pitched like 2 2/3 inning of shutout baseball. Well, that's a guy we've talked about bringing in the rotation. Mm-hmm. So if Guthrie continues to have these struggles, what's preventing us from making, you know, Chris Young an everyday starter? What's preventing us from making Brandon Finnegan a spot start guy up out of the minors? Tommy, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, that start by Guthrie was really bad last Monday against the Yankees, but I think that was more, I mean, he's still been pitching badly. I want to say it's a little bit of an anomaly, though, because it was just bad conditions for him. He's a fly ball pitcher.
Right.
Playing, he was pitching in Yankee Stadium, and the Yankees just loaded their lineup
with
left-handed hitters.
Yep.
And, you know, tomorrow he'll be making the start back home, back in Kauffman, which very much favors his pitching
style.
He's
comfortable in Kauffman because
he'll get these deep fly balls.
Right. He'll get these deep fly balls, which gets him a lot of his outs. He's not a strikeout guy.
No, not at all.
So I see the merit in what you're saying, but go ahead and continue.
So I'm not saying that he's going to come out and, you know, give up, or he's going to hold the Indians to only like 2 runs or something, but I think he has a better chance of succeeding now that he's back home.
But the Royals do have guys coming up like Finnegan in Omaha who have started to prove themselves as starting pitching material.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that's one thing that makes me not so concerned about the Guthrie thing. I think maybe this would be an opportunity if he does have a poor start tomorrow against the Indians to give him some time to maybe refine or, you know, find his pitch again, find, you know, mechanically what's going on, because there's clearly something wrong. It might just be age. He is older. You know, he's in his mid to late, you know, he's in his mid 30s. So it may just be, you know, an age thing. But, you know, I've also seen really good performances from Guthrie this year. You know, we've seen him throw 6 to 7 innings of shutout or, you know, 1 or 2 run baseball. So, you know, you want to see him have a good outing tomorrow. You want to see him progress and settle in. But the pattern shows that might not happen. He might give up 4 or 5 runs, which is fine, but not in the position that he's at right now. You know what I'm saying? He can't afford an average or slightly below average start. He needs to go out there and only allow 1, 2, 3 runs.
Start.
He needs a quality start. He needs to go deeper than 4 or 5 innings. So, you know, enough about Guthrie. Let's focus on the positive from this week. They re-released the most recent polling voting stats for the All-Star game coming up next month in July. And there are 5 Royals leading votes for their position.
Oh, on top of that, Hosmer managed to make up some ground on Cabrera.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Escobar took a huge lead in the shortstop.
Huge lead. Huge. And
Infante is even what?
He's in second.
I think all our guys that were in second or outside, that weren't leading, made up ground.
Yeah, absolutely. Alex Rios is still in contention for an outfield spot, which I think of all the guys that are in leads, he is the least deserving because he's only played 9 games this season. So, you know, clearly, as a Royals fan, you think you want the guys that have been playing all season that deserve it, but there are guys on that list that don't. I definitely don't think Omar Infante deserves to be an all-star starter over Jose Altuve. Jose Altuve has been one of the best players in the majors this year, position thrown out the door. He's been one of the best players, you know, straight up this year. I don't think Alex Rios should be an all-star, but I do think there's legitimate claims to Moose has been one of the best third basemen in baseball. The only other third baseman in the American League you can really make an argument for against him has been Josh Donaldson, who has 10 home runs and 29 RBIs on this season. So those are impressive numbers. Those are better than Moose's numbers. But average-wise, Moose is playing better. Hosmer's having his best year to date so far, but he's behind Cabrera, so that does present a little bit of a roadblock. You're behind one of the best, arguably the best hitter in this era. And then the only other one that I can question maybe is Kane leading over Mike Trout. Now, as a homer, I'm going to say Kane deserves because his wins above replacement are exactly on par with Mike Trout. But from a national standpoint, you know Mike Trout, he's the reigning MVP of the league. He probably should start in the All-Star game, but I'm okay if Lorenzo Cain starts over him. I'm just going to go on record and say that. But the other guys do deserve their spots. Gordon probably deserves to start in the All-Star game, at least from a defensive standpoint. Alcides Escobar has been one of those consistent shortstops in the last 4 or 5 years. So, you know, I think it is great for our national exposure to see these guys. And then Salvi is leading the entire vote of all players.
We actually have the top 3 players.
Yeah, which is exciting. And I, you know, we talked about this, you know, on Friday when we were out getting drinks at Hooper's and on Saturday about what is this indicative of? Why is this happening? Is this Kansas City fans, are they pumping the ballot box? And I think to a certain degree they are. But I think what also has to do with it is there's a national following now that the Royals have now picked up from the World Series run last year through one of the most historic playoff runs there's ever been in baseball. you know, sweeping every series leading up to the World Series, the Royals gained a huge following. I think that has a lot to do with what's going on this year. And I know, Tommy, I know you have your thoughts on this.
I'd say, you know, I do agree that I think we are getting more votes from the exposure we've had. But, I mean, just the way that some of our players are just running away with these positions, I think that's very indicative of the fact that the ballot box is somewhat being stuffed because, you know, you can vote 35 times a day per email address. And, I mean, it's all you need is about – I just did a number crunch today for Sal's vote total that he had. The first update is about 1,400,000. That's only 40,000 people voting for him the max 35 times on just one day to equal that total. So it doesn't take a lot to get you to where you need to be to win.
And now I want to address something that happened recently is that there was an article that was released. It was released on FoxSports.com by one of their staff writers, Stephen Mast. The headline of this article was, "Get voting, people, or it's an all-Royal All-Star game." And he made a case for why certain Royals shouldn't be playing in the All-Star game. And this just leads to a lot of angry Kansas City people. And I think those are people you don't typically want to piss off when it comes to national media exposure. Because they're going to want to stick it to you. Pete Grathoff said it so well in his article in response to it today, is that the anti-Royals fervor is starting as Kansas City dominates All-Star game balloting. I think part of it has to do with the fact that this year it's all fans. It's all online voting by the fans, which puts a lot of heavy influence in uneducated people about the game of baseball. You know, if I'm being honest with myself, I'm not going to vote in Omar Infante over Jose Altuve. And in fact, I didn't when I submitted my All-Star ballot. What are your thoughts on the online voting and how it leaves avenues for people who are less versed in the way that the game is going from season to season and how they can impact that All-Star game?
Well, I think it's interesting. I get the impression that since they eliminated the paper ballots, and I mean, it is easier to vote, but I mean, it's like going to increase the total amount of votes cast, which would make sense, but like the paper votes, they would give them to you, and then you could turn them in right there at the ballpark, which you would think is easier, other than they were kind of a pain in the butt to fill out.
Let's be honest. Those weren't easy by any means. Those were a pain in the ass. You had to get a pencil or a key or something, and then you spend half the game looking down at the ballot. I much prefer this system, but I do see the merit in the old way because people would get people at it in front of them.
It would be baseball people voting
for. Baseball people voting for baseball players. Now you have the whole, you know, the whole world can vote on it now.
It's city versus city, and anyone who has a tie to a city. So, I mean, as unfortunately, it is the Royals fan maybe taking it out of the fans' vote after this year.
Yeah, I think the Royals, if they influence it that heavily, you may see an adjustment just on this one year alone. But I think it's up to other fan bases to get off their sorry asses and start voting if they really want to see their players in the All-Star game. I mean, there's no reason why a small market ball club should be chastised for dominating the All-Star ballot when there should be more people voting for the Royal or vote. Excuse me, just on this level, there should be more people voting for the Red Sox in New York City than there should be people in Kansas City voting for the Royals. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We are such a small market. We're a blip on the radar of baseball markets. There should be more people in Los Angeles voting for the Giants than there should be Royals fans voting for the Royals. So, you know, I don't agree with this whole philosophy that, well, the Royals fan are stuffing the ballot box. Yeah, they are. But there's also other fans that aren't doing jack squat.
It's not limited to us.
Yeah,
other teams can stuff the ballot box.
It's not like we're the only ones getting 35 votes a day. Everyone else is. And so that's where I get frustrated. And I have pretty much had Missouri favor in the way I've voted. I've voted almost exclusively for Royals players and exclusively for Cardinals players. Minus maybe I voted for Jose Altuve instead of Omar Infante, and I voted for Mike Trout. I didn't vote for Mike Trout. Well, I did vote for Mike Trout, but he was one of my three or four All-Star or outfielders that you get. I voted Kane, Gordon, and Trout. So however it plays out, I'm interested to see. It's clear the Royals will have multiple representatives. I think it's safe to assume that just these position players, but Wade Davis will also be in the All-Star game as well. And guess who's managing the All-Star game this year?
Ned Yost.
Ned Yost is managing the All-Star game. So it's all turning up Royal for July, as long as we can keep this up. As long as the Royals can continue to perform as the way they're performing. I'm not sure when the voting closes. I'm guessing sometime probably at the end of June is when the voting closes. But, you know, I'm just – this is a fun time to be in Kansas City, fun time to be watching this team. So we're going to shift gears away from baseball now, still sticking with Kansas City theme. But we're going to go ahead and talk about the Chiefs because Peter King, writer for Sports Illustrated Monday Morning Quarterback, released his power rankings for the NFL coming up this year that came out today. And we see an interesting choice here for the Chiefs. He's ranking the Chiefs ahead of the Denver Broncos as the number four ranked team in his offseason power rankings. Now, these are the far too early to be able to call anything rankings. But the Chiefs, he's got them. We were 9-7 last year. He's got us as the number four team in the NFL. This would even put us ahead of New England Patriots. I don't think we're better than the Pats, but it's nice to have that recognition that we're better than the Pats.
Well, but you also think about it. We did beat the Patriots last year with the Seahawks.
We did beat both Super Bowl teams last year.
I think the Patriots were a different team at that point in the season, but still, right. It's a win, and it counts.
So I just want to kind of talk, you know, outlook on what we have to look forward to this season, what we can expect, what are some of the things we want to see, what are the things we want to see done better, what are the things we want to see go away. I will say that the news last week that left tackle Ryan Clady may have potentially damaged his ACL. I think he did, in fact, tear his ACL and will be out for the season, which depletes an already depleted Denver Broncos offensive line, which does not bode well for aging veteran quarterback, Hall of Fame quarterback Peyton Manning, who has already shown signs of decline last year in the playoffs for the Broncos. So I think now, looking into the 2015 season, with the moves that the Chiefs have made in the offseason, shoring up that offensive line by getting Ben Grubbs, shoring up our offensive firepower by signing Jeremy Maclin, who I'm so excited to see as a deep threat on the outside. Finally, somebody that Alex Smith can hook up with deep, which who knows how often we see that, but it's an interesting prospect that we have. It's now the Chiefs. It's now or never for this Chiefs team. Mm-hmm. I think they've got about a 1 to 2 year window right now to really make a splash, to really make this team, give this team the best opportunity to make it to the Super Bowl, best opportunity to win a championship. They have one of the tougher schedules in football this year. There's a lot of tough teams that we play right away. Tommy, why don't you talk about the schedule a little bit?
Well, so we opened the season at Houston, which doesn't seem too bad.
But considering all the offseason moves they made, I mean, they're a stronger team.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying Houston's a bad team. I'm just saying they haven't played well the past couple seasons.
Right.
But so we'll see how that game goes. But then right after that, we move into 4 days later, a Thursday night game, at home at least, against the Broncos.
Yeah.
And then we follow that up at Green Bay. So that's 2 weeks that'll be very difficult to win. If we can split those games,
right,
I'll be happy.
I would expect us to win that game at home against the Broncos on Thursday night. I would think that is going to be one of the loudest Arrowhead has been games at Arrowhead in a long time. Louder than that Monday night game against the Patriots. It's going to be mayhem that second week against the Broncos on Thursday night. It's going to be absolutely wild, and I think if we can score tickets to that, we should definitely go. So I think the Chiefs are going to win that game. Not handedly, it's going to be a great football game, but I think the Chiefs can win that one, barring some huge setback where Travis Kelce, Jerry Maclin, Jamal Charles, and Alex Smith all somehow go down in a bit of fury, a flaming ball of whatever. That would be the only scenario where I see us not competing at a very high level in that game. But it is going to be a tough year for the Chiefs to try and win the division because of the way their schedule is set up. The Chargers are a little bit worse for the wear, same with the Broncos, but the Raiders have improved significantly in the offseason in comparison to where they were last year. I think the time is now for the Chiefs, but I think they're going to have to prove themselves over and over again this season. A lot of times these good teams don't have to prove themselves all through all 17 weeks of the season. They only have to really catch fire at a certain time because their schedule is so backloaded that they only have to really play well towards the end of the season against those divisional opponents. The Chiefs don't have that luxury because in week 3 you play the Packers, you do play the Lions, you do play the Bears, you do play the Vikings this season. That NFC North is a good division. Those are 4 games that the Chiefs are going to have to work really hard to win. So it's going to be an interesting year for the Chiefs. Brody, what are your thoughts going into this season?
I have really high expectations for this team. We've missed the playoffs or barely made it in the last few years, but this is, I think, the year we win the division. Denver has a major setback. Oakland, as you said, they're the young hot team.
Right.
I think we edge them out in the division. They end up second, Denver third, San Diego fourth.
Yeah, see, I think we're going to go 4-2 against the division. I think we'll split Denver because it's Peyton. Even if it is an aging Peyton Manning, we have only beat him once. Every year he's been in Denver, he's swept us.
Right.
Well, last year at the Arrowhead game, it was a one touchdown game. If Alex Smith doesn't throw an interception, we win.
We win, right.
I think next year is our year.
I do see him winning one game against the Broncos next year. I also see him splitting with the Raiders and then sweeping the Chargers because I think the Chargers are on a somewhat downslope now.
I think this is a statement year for a lot of people on this team. Not just for the team, but for a lot of people on this team. I think it's an opportunity for Alex Smith to make a statement to show him he's not just a conservative, pump-and-dump kind of quarterback. That's not the right expression I want to use. But we can't edit it out now. I think it's an opportunity for Jeremy Maclin to prove he's not just a system guy. He had his career year last year in Chip Kelly's system where he got a lot of receptions for a lot of yards and a decent amount of touchdowns caught from both Nick Foles and from Matt Sanchez. It's an opportunity for him to show that he's worth the money that he made. It's an opportunity for Andy Reid to show that he can really make an impact on this organization. It's an opportunity for John Dorsey to show that everything that he's done up to this point has been for a reason. It's an opportunity for Jamaal Charles to prove that he isn't just going to be a running back on a mediocre team, that he can actually be the guy to carry a team into the playoffs and help a team win a championship. And it's an opportunity for Justin Houston to prove that he's worth the kind of money he's asking for. So there's a lot of things riding on this season for a lot of different people within this organization, not just from players' perspective, but from a front office and from a coaching perspective. And it's an opportunity for Chiefs fans to show why we're the best fans in football, again, which we do every year. So I think there's a lot riding on this year. I think 2015 is going to be huge for both major franchises in Kansas City, but especially for the Kansas City Chiefs. Tommy, anything to add?
Yeah, I wanted to say real quick, because I think the Chiefs subtly fixed two major flaws in the offseason. You know, the offensive line was abysmal last year.
Right.
And they at least made it sustainable. It's not great, but it's serviceable. It's better. It's not going to have Alex Smith on his ass every three plays or something.
Right.
And then on defense, I guess it's not so much a move the Chiefs made, but the fact that we're getting basically our run defense back. We were so bad in run defense, yet our defense overall still ranked fairly well because our pass defense was great.
Yeah.
But we lost Derek Johnson and Mike DeVito way back at the beginning of the season. And those guys will both be back, which, honestly, they're not going to be 100%, but an 85% Derek Johnson is still a great run stopper.
Right. And I think the exciting thing is that both those guys have been rehabbing together all offseason for the same injury. So that adds another chemistry element to your team. When you've got one of your defensive ends and one of your go-to middle linebacker, inside linebacker, that have now developed and forged this relationship that's probably pretty special when you have to think about it. They've been spending all year rehabbing and they've probably got to know each other better than teammates get to know each other, which is pretty well. I think it's going to be a special year for this defense. And I'm especially excited to see how Marcus Peters, the first-round draft pick, out of Washington fits in, because I think he's going to make an immediate impact on the secondary. And like some journalists have said, I think he's going to be one of those corners that someday we name an island after, like a Revis Island. So we'll see. So that's about all we have on the Chiefs this week. We do want to move into kind of the national news, the national sporting news, talk about something that spans not just the United States, but spans the world, spans politics, it spans the economy, it spans betting and greed and everything. The story's got all the pieces to it. It is the FIFA scandal. So we'll go ahead and start talking about that. It's a dicey story because there's a lot of different narratives that you're hearing about it. You hear about this guy, Sepp Blatter, who was reelected as the president for FIFA. You hear about the U.S. Department of Justice announcing a wide-range indictment against these dozens of FIFA officials within their rating body. You don't even have to be a soccer fan or a sports fan to realize that this has huge implications from a national news perspective. Something has gone awry here, and the U.S. Justice Department is going to try and get to the bottom of it. And the United States has been getting a lot of praise for the way that they've gone in and injected themselves into this situation and tried to rid FIFA of the scum that have been governing it for the last couple decades. Brody, you are the closest to the situation with your intense soccer fandom, at least intense for the people in this room. What are your thoughts on the whole situation? Why don't you give us a little background into what's going on?
So FIFA is the international head of all of soccer.
Yeah.
And their main kind of what U.S. fans would kind of know is they are the head of determining where the World Cup is for every 4 years. The 2022 World Cup is supposed to be held in Qatar.
Right.
And it's come out that there's been almost $150 million in embezzlement. I mean, it's staggering the amount of just scandal that's going on.
Right, and eyebrows were already raised when they decided that was going to be played in Qatar, because FIFA is traditionally, it has always been, a summer soccer tournament.
Yes.
It happens in the middle of summer. It's great because people who have summer vacations and everything can watch the games, or they can go to the site of where it's being played. People went to Brazil last summer and went and watched these games, and it's a really exciting time. And then we went to Qatar, which is a goddamn desert in the middle of summer, which is essentially means you have to move it to winter.
And that interrupts all of the national play from European leagues and everywhere.
Right. So before you even knew that there was backdoor deals and all this controversy going on, you knew something was up. Because you have to scratch your head and say, what the hell, FIFA? Why are you moving a summer tournament to Qatar that's traditionally held in the middle of summer and now moving it to winter?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't make a whole lot of sense. It just makes you, you know, wonder what the hell's going on.
Well, we're this upset about the fact that they changed when the tournament is. I mean, let's not even get started on the fact that 1,200 workers, migrant workers estimated to date, have died building the stadium for the 2022 World Cup.
Right.
With an estimate that they're going to lose another 3,000 more.
Yeah.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, you are literally, I mean, people's lives, people are losing their lives. Top it all off, you've got Sepp Blatter, who is still reigning as president of FIFA, who's acting like he's one of the untouchables.
No. He is the true Bond villain.
Yeah, no, he is.
He is the embodiment. He forces Brazil to change its laws of drinking beer in the stadium, which was changed because people were dying. Because Bud Light was a sponsor, Sepp Blatter went in and told Brazil, you're going to have to change that law to serve beer.
And not just, I mean, that's the worst of the things. That's the least of the terrible things that happened in Brazil. The Brazilian economy was not positively affected by the World Cup being hosted there. You go and you look at these economic impact studies that happen. When events like that are hosted by major cities and major countries like that, there's supposed to be some sort of
kickback.
Eventually, the economic impact positive that happens. That didn't happen. And these stadiums that have been built in Brazil have essentially been abandoned now and aren't even really used for anything. Some of these stadiums that were built, you know, far out.
Was in the jungle where there wasn't a city around.
Right. There wasn't anything near it. And so is anyone playing games in that stadium anymore? No.
I think the jungle probably took that one.
Yeah, the jungle probably took back the stadium. So you've got 2018 in Russia, which is still questionable.
I was going to say, let's just think about that. It's Russia. Probably didn't get it straight up. Although it does make a little more sense for them. They are a major country.
Right. And
it has a little bit more understanding why you would put it there.
Right. They know they have the infrastructure, not a great infrastructure, but they have the infrastructure to at least make it possible. It's not like Qatar, where it's probably pretty clear that money was getting, even if they didn't do this whole federal indictment, people knew that there was money being exchanged there. So it's frustrating as a sports fan. It's frustrating as a
human
American
being.
Citizen. It's frustrating as a human being. It's frustrating as a citizen of the world that you have to hear about these injustices taking place, where these multimillionaires are sitting on piles of cash, continuing to take backdoor deals, continuing to get all this money, and they just have no regard for human safety, human life, you know, decency. It just goes out the door. And so I think it's a great step for the U.S. Department of Justice to indict these people for their crimes. If I was Sepp Blatter, I'd be very careful about where I travel over the next couple months, because if they have any sort of extradition relationship with the United States, they're hauling his ass to the U.S. I mean, that guy better not go to Canada, because he was supposed to go to Canada for the Women's World Cup, which is coming up soon, which I'm really excited about. I'm just going to go ahead and soapbox for a minute. I have so much fun watching the United States women's soccer team play in the Women's World Cup. It is as exciting, if not sometimes more so, than the Men's World Cup. But back to Sepp Blatter. He better be careful where he steps down on which country's soil he takes in his next trip to, because we're coming after him.
So you got to imagine he's now carrying a little list his lawyer provided him with that tells him which countries he can go in and which
countries. Yeah, Nope, so you cannot go to Canada. They've never not extradited someone to the United States.
Sir, that's literally bordering the United States. How did you think they were going to take you back?
Right. So, you know, it's like I said, it's frustrating. And we don't know a whole lot yet because they haven't, you know, handed down all the charges. And it's an indictment, so we don't really know what's going to happen yet. But, you know, we'd like to see something done. So that's enough about the whole FIFA scandal. We'll go ahead and transition to something a little more positive. The Golden State Warriors are playing in their first NBA Finals in the last 30 years. The last time they played was in 1975. Rick Barry was the star on the team then. This year they've got a plethora of stars, but that star-studded roster is led by none other than the MVP, Steph Curry, who's been making headlines not only on the court, but in the media recently with his adorable daughter, Riley Curry, in his press conferences. It melts your heart every time you see her up there. You know, she reminds me a lot of a younger version of Olivia from The Cosby Show, just in the way she's so cute. She loves being in the spotlight. And she's made Steph Curry that much more of a likable player. Not that he wasn't already likable before, but now you've got him and his wife at the Giants game, getting on the kiss cam. I mean, he is literally winning over America with every single three-point shot. He's winning over America with every single post-game conference. Hell, he's winning over America when he goes to enjoy a baseball game on his off days. So I think most of America is cheering for the Golden State Warriors and Steph Curry against LeBron James, as he's the prodigal son, which has now returned to the Cleveland Cavaliers, that are they're reappearing in the finals for the first time since he took them there with the Cavs back in 2007. So it's exciting because you have the best player in basketball going up against the best player in basketball this year, or at least, you know, in the eyes of the voters, in Steph Curry. He's the MVP, the most valuable player, against the best player of this era. So it's going to be exciting. You've got a lot of premier matchups. You've got really good point guard play from both Steph Curry and, if there's a healthy Kyrie Irving, a healthy Kyrie Irving. Great play from the shooting guard position with both Klay Thompson, who's emerged as a budding all-star, who is the you know, the number two to Steph Curry this year, against J.R. Smith, who has kind of rejuvenated his career in this postseason with the Cleveland Cavaliers. Then you've got Harrison Barnes at the three for the Warriors up against LeBron James at the three for the Cavs. Harrison Barnes has had a great playoff. Then you've got Draymond Green, the mouth, the warrior. He's been everything for the Warriors this year. Finished second in the Defensive Player of the Year voting, up against, you know, Tristan Thompson of the Cleveland Cavaliers. And then you've got Timofey Mozgov, the bullying center out of Russia, playing for the Cleveland Cavaliers, against Andrew Bogut, who's just as brutish and dirty, playing for the Warriors. So it's going to be a very exciting series. The Warriors clearly have the edge from the bench perspective. They've got a very deep team, but the Cavaliers have the best player. So I kind of wanted to talk to you guys. I know you guys aren't the most well-versed in NBA basketball, but you've watched a lot this postseason, or at least enough to know, you know, where these teams stand, how they stack up. So your thoughts on how you see the series playing out, how many games you see it going to, and then maybe your pick for who you think the Finals MVP is going to be. Tommy, we'll go ahead and start with you.
Well, you know, I really see this game going, or this series going six or seven games, because I think these teams are very evenly matched. I mean, you do have LeBron on the Cavs, best player right now, but then Steph Curry is just playing out of his mind this whole season. And so the way they've gone through the playoffs, I think the Warriors have the more talented roster, but I think the Cavs are hotter right now. Just the way they've been playing, they've had closer series, which gives them a bigger confidence boost when they have to meet up.
You know, yeah, in clutch situations.
Yeah.
And they did just sweep the best team in the East in their last series. I mean, they beat Atlanta in four games, which is, you know, Atlanta may not have been the most prepared for this playoff run as the as prepared as the Cavaliers were in terms of catching fire at the right time. Because as we know, in any sport, and the Royals know this better than a lot of people, it's all about momentum. It's all about catching fire at the right time. And I think the Cavaliers are doing that. That said, you know, it's really very dependent on the health of Kyrie Irving and whether or not he's able to play at 100% or at least at a high level going into this Finals appearances. So with that said, what's your prediction? Who's going to win and how many games, and who's your Finals MVP?
I'm going to go, since I'm not very good at picking, I'm just going to go with the team I'm cheering for. I'm going to go Warriors in seven games, and I think Steph Curry is going to be the MVP.
Okay. I think that's a safe bet. Brody, your thoughts?
You know, my pick is going to be the Warriors, but I'll say five games.
Five games.
I think
betting against the King.
I am saying when it's only the King, he's got Irving. Is he coming back in game one? Or is
he'll be back for game one. That's the presumption that both Clay and Kyrie are healthy for game one.
Yeah, and so I mean, it's the injuries. Their bench is not as strong. I think the Warriors run away with it.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of torn between both of your guys' responses. So I'll go ahead and go Warriors in six, only because I think that, like Brody alluded to, their bench is very deep. When you look at their bench and you see guys occupying the bench at the start of the game that include Andre Iguodala, they include David Lee, who both could start really on almost any other team in the NBA. Then you've got Festus Ezeli at the center position. You've got Sean Livingston. That's a really deep nine-guy rotation right there. And you don't see a lot of that this late into a season. You can really go nine deep. So that's what I'm really impressed about with this Warriors team, which is why I think they have the edge talent-wise. When you talk about the Cavaliers, they are a little depleted in terms of how much talent they have. They don't really go top to bottom as well as the Warriors do. But you still have Iman Shumpert coming off the bench. So you've got some talent there. You've got James Jones, who, you know, he's spotty. So, but I'm really, really interested to see is who guards LeBron in this series. And I think that will dictate how this tempo goes, because you have two options if you're Steve Kerr in the Warriors. You can put Harrison Barnes on him and then have Iguodala guard him when Barnes is not on the floor. Or you can have Draymond Green guard him when he's on the floor. Now, I think the smart move would be to play Harrison Barnes on LeBron James because he's more athletic. And I think that he would have a step on Draymond Green. You can put Draymond Green on Tristan Thompson and have him kind of take up space in the middle. But the guard play, I think, is what you're going to look to see how this series goes. Not only you look to see how LeBron plays, and you look to see how the duo of Curry and Klay Thompson goes. Because if Klay and Curry are both hitting and firing on all cylinders in this series, I don't think there's any way that the Warriors don't win this in six games. Now, we do have to wait and see how the concussion test results come back from Klay Thompson, because I mean, the guy was bleeding from his ear in that final game against the Rockets, taking the knee to the head from Trevor Ariza. So, you know, you hope that he's healthy because you want the best players on the floor. I think this series would be a little bit more interesting if Kevin Love was healthy and was going to be playing. That said, I still think the Cavaliers present a formidable opponent to the Golden State Warriors. However, I just think that this team, the way they played all season, is a team of destiny. I think Steph Curry is the best shooter in the history of the NBA. I think he will go on. This will not be his last championship, nor do I think this will be his last MVP. I think this is where Steph Curry makes a statement, as he should be considered one of the top five players in the NBA. You're going to see him for the next decade surrounded with names like LeBron James, like Kevin Durant. And then after those two, I don't really know if I could name somebody that's better than him. And I would go so far as to say LeBron James is number one and Steph Curry is number two, only because Durant hasn't been around this season to really, you know, maintain his reign as the most valuable player. I think right now this is Steph Curry's association. He's the king of this league, and I think they're going to win it in six. So that wraps up our all of our talk regarding the finals. We'll be back, you know, next week, when we'll talk a little more about how that series is progressing. But for now, we're going to go on to our next topic of today, which is the episode 8 of Game of Thrones, which aired last night. We haven't talked about Game of Thrones a whole lot on the pod recently, just because we get talking about other things. But I think this episode from last night has to be addressed because of the magnitude of it, because of the implications of everything that are going to happen as a result of what occurred on the episode. And I think we just have to talk about how epic and awesome last night's episode was. So for those of you that saw the episode, you can continue to listen. If you did not see the episode or are trying to catch up, turn off the show now. Spoiler alert, you don't want to hear us talk about Game of Thrones.
Has anyone ever talked about Game of Thrones and not had a spoiler?
I think it's impossible.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyways, so then the episode 8, Hard Home. Most of the episode takes place in the Wildling settlement of Hard Home, north of the Wall. Jon Snow is with Tormund Giantsbane trying to convince Rattleshirt and the rest of the Wildlings to join them. The Fen and the Wildlings, you know, are all together trying to convince them to come south of the Wall and settle at the Gift. and you know, farm that land, and then the time comes for the White Walkers to show up, then they join together and they fight together. Well, the White Walkers showed up a little bit sooner than expected, and they crashed the party at Hardhome. But before that, we saw just another boss badass scene from Tormund Giantsbane where he bitches Rattleshirt. I mean, he beats him literally to a pulp with his staff. That was awesome. And that scene kind of just set the tone for the entire episode. And there are bits and pieces on other parts of the show that are taking place. Arya is starting to progress in the House of Black and White. Cersei is sucking dirty dishwater off the floor of a dingy dungeon. It's a lot of D's in that last sentence. And is awaiting her trial with the Faith Militant. But the main story, and the story I'm so excited they're delving deeper into, is Jon Snow's story with the wildlings in North of the Wall. Now, this isn't exactly how it happened in the books, but some of this to a degree did happen. So that scene with the White Walkers, Brody, why don't you talk me about it? What was going through your mind when you saw all the action going on screen last night?
I mean, it was just intense. Like, yeah. I was leaning back, kind of watching it as a normal Game of Thrones of kind of saying ooh and ah, or laughing at a joke that Tyrion makes.
Right.
But this, I mean, just awesome.
Right.
Just awesome.
And I think for any given week, what had occurred in that episode up into the White Walker invasion would have been enough to kind of carry it into the next week's episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had the back and forth between Daenerys and Tyrion, which I think we've been waiting for pretty much since we started this fifth season, knowing what was going to, or excuse me, is this the fourth or fifth season?
Fifth.
The fifth season. Knowing that they would eventually meet up in Essos, in Meereen. But this was just like the pinnacle of what you've been waiting for all season. These last two episodes have kind of been dragging a little bit. There hasn't been a whole lot, and it feels like they've kind of used this like shock of using rape in these scenes to kind of forward the story between Ramsay, raping Sansa, and then, you know, in previous episodes, you know, you had Jaime raping Cersei, all these things. You don't want them to focus on that element, that, you know, that sexual shock factor has been kind of what this show's relied on recently. I do like what has happened now. Now they're focusing on the magic elements of the show. They're focusing on the battles. They're focusing on developing one of the central characters who potentially could be the key to saving the realm in Jon Snow, and then also focusing on these other two people who are probably the best for the realm in mm-hmm. Daenerys and in Tyrion. So now the White Walkers are loose, and the Night King has now raised all these wildlings that were killed at Hardhome up, and the episode ends as Jon. It ends with 2 minutes of silence.
Are you not entertained?
Yeah, you really felt like that's what the Night King would say. Like, are you not entertained? Like raising all these hundreds of people from the dead. And it was just a really great sequence. Tommy, what are your thoughts on the episode from last night?
Well, you know, that scene with the White Walkers was so terrifying because I was reading a little bit more about it today. Just, one of the articles people write that go over stuff. And they pointed out, and something that I hadn't really noticed at first, that really through that whole fight, they weren't really fighting, you know, the traditional White Walkers. They were fighting just kind of the army of the dead, and he only killed one White Walker.
Right.
But the fact that they got massacred so much by just regular, you know, kind of an army of dead people that you can still beat with mortal weapons.
Right.
So you got to be kind of scared for the fact that there is, you know, still an army of White Walkers too.
Right.
And also, were you not real creeped out when that scene kind of, I think it was about the middle of the scene when Jon Snow looked up at the top of the cliff there, and you saw four people sitting on horses there, you know, a little reminiscent of four horsemen.
In the apocalypse, yeah. I think one of the scenes that now gets into the kind of the mythology of Westeros and of this whole world that George R. R. Martin has so masterfully created is the myth behind Valyrian steel and what Valyrian steel is. For those of you that don't know, Valyrian steel was created in Valyria back in... Valyria is the part of the show where Tyrion and Jorah are sailing through Valyria, old Valyria, and the Stone Men come out and... they touch Jorah, and he now has the markings of the Stone Men on his arm, which will inevitably spread around the rest of his body. Old Valyria was one of these. It's like ancient Rome. It was one of these at the height of its magnificence. It was the greatest culture the world had ever seen, and so they had this Valyrian steel that was had magical powers. That's what we saw with Jon Snow, where when the White Walker goes to slash down on Jon Snow with his blade, and it doesn't shatter Jon Snow's blade like we saw it do with the other regular, normal weapons. So, you know, people who hadn't watched the show were like, oh, does Jon Snow have magical powers? He might, because he is a he can warg in the books. Warg is when you insert yourself into the body of an animal and you can control it. But the real power lied in the blade, the Valyrian steel blade that he had been his father's. So that was a really cool moment for the show. And now I've seen think that Game of Thrones has set themselves up. David Benioff and D.B. Weiss have set themselves up where these next two episodes really have to deliver. Because if this is episode 8, then 9 and 10 have to be excellent. And they've historically had great episode 8, episodes 9, 9s, and then 10 kind of carries you into what's going to happen next season. It's kind of that wrap-up episode. So I'm expecting something magnificent next episode. Something crazy. Cersei's trial, or perhaps some sort of thing she has to do as a way of penance for what she's done and her crimes. Who knows? We'll see. It's interesting to see how that Brienne storyline with Sansa will develop, what's going to happen. I'd like to see less torture by the hands of Ramsay Bolton. I think we had enough of that back in season 3 when Theon lost his member. The story I'm expecting the most out of, the most intrigue from, is Jaime and Bronn and Dorne, because this has been kind of a lackluster storyline recently, and you want more from it. Because in the books, Ilaria Sand and the Sand Snakes are intriguing characters. They are very secondary characters, but they're intriguing characters nonetheless, and they're not really doing a whole lot of justice to the Martell house with this storyline recently. They've only shown Doran Martell as kind of this weak, a man of no action kind of leader over in Dorne, whereas Oberyn was kind of the highlight of last season from a character perspective. He only lasted about 8 episodes, but, you know, you want to see more from Dorne because you've grown to expect a certain element from that, just from the character of Oberyn. So I'm excited to see how that Dorne, Jaime and Doran, their relationship, and how Doran will now try and bring Jaime into an alliance with the Martells. It'll be very interesting. So I'm expecting a lot from these next 2 weeks. Tommy, what are your thoughts on these next two episodes?
Yeah, you know, I really do want to see a lot more happen in Dorne, because I feel like that's kind of, there's a lot that can go with that right now, and they only have 2 episodes left to do something right with it. And I also want to see something happen at Winterfell, because I don't like the way Sansa's been treated there, obviously.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I really think something's going to happen there. Either with, like, Theon's going to get killed, or he's going to do something.
Right.
You know, you kind of saw a little bit of his humanity come back in this last episode when he finally admitted that he did not kill Brandon Rickon.
Yeah.
He just killed 2 random farm kids.
Boys. Yeah. So there's a lot that could happen, and a lot that, you know, Brody and I as book readers don't know what will happen, because so much has changed drastically from the books. I mean, at this point, you know, Daenerys and Tyrion have not met in the books. There's a fate of Jon Snow's, which we have learned in the books, but we don't even know if it's going to play out in the show now. So who knows? There's a lot that can happen, and we have 2 weeks to find out. So I'm definitely excited. Brody, how about you?
I mean, it's just going to be not Red Wedding level, I think, for episode 9, but it'll definitely have a great twist probably at the end.
Yeah, and so we're looking forward to that. We're still expecting to see Jorah Mormont, down in the fighting pits with Daenerys watching, and there's a lot of things that can still happen. So we're looking forward to that. So that wraps up pretty much everything we wanted to talk about this week on the show. As a group, collectively, we did want to say we were really happy to see Tracy Morgan in his first public interview today, able to talk about that terrible tragedy that occurred to him last year and that terrible accident that nearly took his life and did take the life of a good close friend of his. But it's good to see him up and about. He is walking now at the use of a cane, but as all 3 of us fans of 30 Rock and fans of Saturday Night Live and fans of just laughing in general, we're very happy to see Tracy Morgan speaking and up and about. So, we're sending prayers his way as we continue to. But as fans of comedy, we would have to say we're really excited to see him up and about and talking for the first time publicly since that horrific tragedy last year. So that just concludes our show. We appreciate your patience in waiting for 2 weeks for a new episode. That was never our intent to make it that long in between the hiatus, but that's just the way our schedules work out. We're busy. We're busy people. Sometimes duty calls and we have to go off and do other things like travel to Houston or spend a nice weekend out at the lake. So, you know, sometimes things interfere with what your obligations typically are. But we're excited to be back, and we're going to continue to hopefully bring you guys great talk radio, great podcast, and great content. As always, we encourage you guys to participate with us by emailing us at builtontheborder@gmail.com or tweeting at us at BorderKC on Twitter or tweeting at our personal handles at Tommy Jeffy and at
T. Riley. Actually, I don't know my handle.
Yeah, or at Broads McGoads.
Broads McGoads.
At Broads McGoads. So we'd love to hear your thoughts on how we can make this show better, what you guys would like to hear us talk about, what we can talk about better, mistakes that we made on the show. We always want to, you know, have our fact checkers going and look at that. But we don't have fact checkers. Maybe someday, but we don't now. So for Broderick Johnson and Mr. Thomas Watson, I am your host, Tommy Randolph, signing out of yet another edition of the Built on the Border podcast. As we leave you today, we're going to leave you with a song that Mr. Watson has picked out. That is Lean On by Major Lazer featuring DJ Snake. And we'll let you guys that carry you guys out of the pod today. Have a great week. Go Royals, go Chiefs, and go Kansas City. Stay safe out there, guys. Have a good one.